right, we're back. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hours Editorial Review, the second half on this Sunday evening. Now, the Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hours Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Editorial Review and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. The Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, and in the light of Bible prophecy, biblical law, and scriptural history, so stay tuned for tonight's special report right after this message. Well, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, privacy, and our property. By powerful government agencies, multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power, and the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property, not the Congress or the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to the one who is indifferent thereto, because it is a fighting clause and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. And it cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor, and it's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. Now, that's a citation directly from United States versus Johnson, and that's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and less to the politicians and the lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said plainly that your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School, and it's entertaining, educational, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for home education with all of the supporting paperwork. If you're online, you can go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Now, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. You ever heard of the Prochazski rule? It's quite a story. I had a student in here many years ago. And about 1990, the law in Tennessee changed, and when you went in to get your driver's license, you had to have a Social Security number. Well, Stan had a driver's license, and he needed to get it renewed, but he had rescinded his Social Security number in the meantime. So when he went in to get a driver's license, he said, well, I don't have a Social Security number, and they said, no number, no license. And Stan said, well, I'm a religious objector, and because of that, I need a license with an exemption. I said, well, not in this state. Now, at the present time, 37 states no longer require Social Security numbers, or they have an exemption. 13 states do not. Tennessee was one of those states, and I presume still is. So Stan, now having been damaged, because remember, driving is a privilege, but the right to the driver's license is a right. So you have a right to the privilege. And he said, I've been denied my right to the privilege because of my religious beliefs, since I believe that the Social Security account number is the mark of the beast, and I refuse to participate in the mark of the beast program pursuant to Revelation 13. Which is truly and sincerely held under Seeger versus U.S. I'm being discriminated against and I need a remedy. So Stan went in with what's known as a writ of mandamus, and this is now called the Perchowski Rule. And Perchowski, under the writ of mandamus, got the legislature to pass a special law just for this one individual. This is the only guy in the state who is exempted from the Social Security number. So keep in mind that you can go to your state legislator, that is your state representative, and have a special law passed for you in many cases. But listen to this. Here's another guy. A Hampton couple's, this is Hampton, see where this is located, Hampton Roads, Virginia. A Hampton couple's attempt to disassociate themselves from their Social Security numbers because of their religious beliefs was dealt a legal setback Friday when a judge convicted Leslie Carmichael of driving without a valid license. Neither Carmichael nor her husband have carried a driver's license since 2002, when the Department of Motor Vehicles refused to renew their licenses without Social Security numbers. Although the numbers aren't required to be on the licenses, the DMV told Carmichaels that the numbers were needed for record-keeping purposes. The Carmichaels believe the Social Security number issued by the government is a sign of the Antichrist talked about in the Bible's Book of Revelation. Well, after David Carmichael came to that belief in the mid-1990s, he wrote to the Social Security Administration and asked that any applications for numbers for his family be rescinded. His quest has cost him his job as a chief, or as a Navy chief petty officer, threatened his financial security, and gotten him and now his wife in trouble with the law. Well, in October, Leslie Carmichael, a stay-at-home mom, who homeschools the couple's four children, was stopped for speeding and got a ticket for not having a license. She was convicted in Hampton General District Court and then appealed the decision. Well, the case landed in circuit court on Friday before Judge Wilford Taylor, who listened to attorney Herb Titus, who argued the constitutionality surrounding Social Security numbers before saying there wasn't much that he could do at his level. This is not the court to hold a statute like this unconstitutional or constitutional, Taylor said, suggesting that Carmichael first followed DMV's administrative review process. Titus had argued that the DMV commissioner erred in not considering a waiver of the Social Security requirement when David Carmichael asked that he and his family be exempted from having to provide the numbers on driver's license applications. Well, under Virginia code, the commissioner has the authority to waive regulations on a case-by-case basis, Titus said. Now, using words from the Virginia Act for Religious Freedom drafted by Thomas Jefferson in the 1700s, Titus argued that Carmichael has a constitutional right not to be molested or bothered because of her religious opinion. We have a religious conviction not to associate with Social Security numbers, Leslie Carmichael testified Friday. It's something we walk every day in every area of our lives. After declining to dismiss the case, effectively pushing the constitutional issue aside, Taylor was left to rule on whether Carmichael was driving without a valid license when she was stopped in Hampton last year. She confessed, the judge said. He convicted her on the charge and fined her $50. Afterward, the Carmichael said they're going to continue their fight. We have no choice. And he said this is our life and our way of life. And David Carmichael, who said he's heard from other Virginians who share similar beliefs, said that he may consider a class action suit against the DMV. I don't think a class action suit's the right form of action. I think it's a takings case. That's my personal opinion. But you can remedy that by going to your state legislator or going in by a writ of mandamus. Mandamus is the correct extraordinary remedy. It's chapter 15 in my courtroom strategy and procedures class. class. There are 47 of these extraordinary remedies, of which mandamus, prohibition, quo warranto, certiorari, and habeas corpus are among those. Now, here's an old student of mine, a guy by the name of Michael Keene out in California, and he wrote an article similar to the one that we've just covered. Here's what Mike had to say. Thanks for writing, Mike. Now, for those of you who keep or of you keeping a scorecard on the issue of right to travel, maybe you'd like to copy and paste some of this into your paperwork. It came from a Washington State Attorney General's opinion from 1959. And as you can see, this subject appears to be too simple for government officials to understand. Below is about as simple as you can get, and I'm not sure who it was who put this up on a website, but I appreciate it. Personal liberty. This is a definition here. Personal liberty, or the right to the enjoyment of life and liberty, is one of the fundamental or natural rights which has been protected by its inclusion as a guarantee in the various constitutions, which is not derived from or dependent on the federal constitution, and which may not be submitted to a vote and may not depend on the outcome of an election. It's one of the most sacred and valuable rights, as sacred as the right of private property or as occupying a preferred position, as contrasted with property rights, and is regarded as inalienable. Now, this concept is further amplified in 11 American jurisprudence under constitutional law, wherein it is said, quote, personal liberty largely consists of the right of locomotion, to go where and when one pleases, only so far restrained as the rights of others may make it necessary for the welfare of all other citizens. Now, the right of a citizen to travel on a public highway and to transport his property thereon by horse-drawn carriage, wagon, or automobile is not a mere privilege which may be permitted or prohibited at will, but it's a common right which he has under his right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Under this constitutional guarantee, one may therefore, under normal conditions, travel at his inclination along the public highways or in public places, and while conducting himself in an orderly and decent manner, neither interfering with or disturbing another's rights, he'll be protected, not only in his person, but in his safe conduct. And in Barber v. Walker, the distinction between the right of a citizen to use the public highways for private use rather than commercial purposes is recognized. In Ex parte Dickey, that is Dickey v. Davis, listening to the Law Hours Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest, and all of these Editorial Review programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of any alleged crime, and what should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits, and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements, 28 things that you need to know to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. And rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent's ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. And after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, and best of all, free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available. The school is available on compact disc for home education. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and then send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that package now is free. The school isn't, but the package is. Now, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we had to take a break here. I was cut off here in the middle of a sentence, practically. Mike Keene sent me an email here, and he said, in Ex Parte Dickey, now this is Dickey V. Davis, we find this apt expression of the court. It says, quote, the right of a citizen to travel on a public highway and transport his property thereon in the ordinary course of life and business differs radically and obviously from that of one who makes the highway his place of business and uses it for private gain in the running of a stagecoach or an omnibus. Now, the former is the usual and ordinary right of a citizen, a right common to all, to use the highway, while the latter is special, unusual, and extraordinary. Now, as to the former, the extent of legislative power is that of regulation. But as to the latter, its power is broader. The right may be wholly denied, or it may be permitted to some and denied to others because of its extraordinary nature. This distinction, elementary and fundamental in character, is recognized by all of the authorities. So as to the power of the legislature to prohibit or condition special or extraordinary uses of the highway, for instance, commercial use as it sees fit. So if you're going to move a house up and down the street, you got to get a permit. Now, if you're going to use the highway for travel, that's a right. So there are rights and privileges. Now, under its power to regulate private use of our highways, our legislature has required that motor vehicle operators be licensed. Now, undoubtedly, the primary purpose of this requirement is to ensure, insofar as possible, that all motor vehicle operators will be competent and qualified, thereby reducing the potential hazard or risk of harm to which other users of the highway might otherwise be subject. But once having complied with this regulatory provision by obtaining the requisite operator's license, a motorist enjoys the privilege of traveling freely on the public highway without unauthorized detention or restraint. Now, we cannot overlook the merit in and forcefulness of the argument that a broad delegation of authority is essential to the enforcement of the licensing requirement. However, a right as precious as the freedom of an individual who has not violated any law to travel wherever he pleases without interruption should not be denied by implication where an equally consistent construction not impairing such right is possible. Now, the question arises, how does the Social Security number impair anybody's ability to operate a motor vehicle or qualify for a driver's license? Do people without Social Security numbers violate more laws than do people with Social Security numbers? Do people who do not possess Social Security numbers operate more dangerously, more recklessly, have more accidents, or cause more problem than people with Social Security numbers? should be pretty obvious that having or not having a Social Security number is irrelevant. It's an identification process, and your driver's license is, in effect, your national identification. It's your citizen's passport. In many countries, they have compulsory identification. In America, we use Social Security and driver's license as your identifiers. So what you may need here is a Prochowski rule in your state of Virginia. Here's a neat story, kind of an unusual one. Masked members of a group called the Gay Militia stormed into a meeting of Christians discussing a bill that would criminalize certain opposition to homosexual behavior in Canada. Now, a videotape of the incident shows the intruders with bandana-covered faces bursting into a meeting room at the Coast Plaza Hotel in Calgary, Alberta, where the Concerned Christian Coalition Incorporated was holding its national convention Saturday night, the Calgary Sun reported. "Right-wing bigots, go away. Gay militias here to stay," the intruders chanted. The Calgary paper said about 7 females and 1 male from the homosexual group were in the room as about 25 members of the convention held hands and prayed aloud. The female gay militia members unfurled a banner that read, "Liberation, Queer Invasion." Calgary police are reviewing several videotapes of the meeting, and an investigation is underway. According to Police Constable Doug Jones, the Hate Bias Crime Coordinator for the Police Cultural Resource Unit, what we're looking at, if we can identify the protesters, is mischief charges, disturbing a peaceful assembly kind of stuff, he told the Sun. Jim Blake, a member of the Christian group, told the paper that he was dumbfounded at the fact that the gay militia would storm into a private meeting where we were praying and discussing Bill C-250, a bill that will affect our freedom as Christians to discuss our beliefs. Well, the controversial bill, which passed the House of Commons last September, adds sexual orientation as a protected category in Canada's genocide and hate crimes legislation, which carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison. As WorldNet Daily reported, opponents fear that if it becomes law, the Bible will be deemed hate literature under the criminal code in certain instances, as evidenced by the case of a Saskatchewan man fined by a provincial human rights tribunal for taking out a newspaper ad with scriptural references to verses about homosexuality. The bill now is in the Senate, where it has overwhelming support, but 2 amendments were introduced on April the 1st, delaying a vote. The Senate has recessed until April the 20th, when a vote is scheduled. The CCC feels that all groups have a right to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the freedom to assemble and protect their deeply held personal and moral beliefs, Blake told the Calgary paper. The Sun said the gay militia would not comment. There's an editor's note. The current edition of the WND's acclaimed monthly whistleblower magazine, titled Sexual Anarchy, is devoted entirely to the explosive issue of homosexual marriage and shows, contrary to popular opinion, that same-sex marriage may very soon become the law of the land in America. The issue also shows, perhaps for the first time, how same-sex marriage can be stopped dead in its tracks, regardless of the actions of activist judges. Just thought you'd like to stay alert and stay aware of what's going on in Canada. Evidently, the people of Canada don't like free speech. The free speech of Bible believers is throttled, and the free speech of homosexuals is legal and lawful. And so what they're doing is going into the legislature. Now, this is kind of odd, because here in the United States, the homosexuals claim that they've got 10% of the population. It's strange how 10% of the population can control the other 90%. what it boils down to is called pansexualism. Now, while the homosexuals only control 10% of the population who are openly gay, you see, about 90% of the total population believes in sexual freedom. You know, just conventional adultery, fornication, and sleeping with your wife, that's fine. They're not gay, but they don't want any sexual restraints. And so a person who is a criminal of and by himself is very reluctant to want to enforce laws against other criminals of the same criminal bent. In other words, if you're a bank robber, you know, it's hardly in your best interests to want to promote law and order against theft and shoplifting. And so a bank robber isn't opposed to a shoplifter, a pickpocket, or a car thief, is he? I mean, after all, they're all birds of a feather and they flock together. So what we have in the world is a sexual or a moral or an immoral moral climate. How am I going to word that? We have an amoral climate, which is headed toward immoral. And the immoral people, that is the sodomites, have run into the amoral people, and the amoral people are not necessarily going to vocally or vociferously oppose the immoral crowd. And so, of course, the immorals have gone to the legislature and said, hey, give us these hate crime laws. And the legislature, which is amoral, says, well, yeah, it sounds reasonable to us. I mean, after all, we're criminals. When we go to a political convention, we're out chasing prostitutes, so why should we get upset about gays chasing their fellow men? So it's that way in Canada, it's that way in the United States, and it'll get to the point where the Bible will, I believe, be branded as hate literature. I mean, after all, God condemns both camps. Here's a story from Fleet Bank. Maybe you didn't know this, but the banks keep records on people, and these records that the banks keep are used by government. Listen to this. Now, Fleet Bank reports, which were obtained by the FBI, show that an MIT biology graduate and her husband bought high-tech military equipment and may have been plotting terror attacks from their Mission Hill apartment, according to a published report. The guy's name is Afia, it's A-A-F-I-A, Afia, maybe it's Afia, Siddiqui, a 34-year-old Pakistani national. It's a female, she's a mother of three. She fled Boston, and she's now wanted for questioning by the FBI, so reports Newsweek magazine. It's an ongoing investigation, and we're still trying to locate her, said Boston FBI spokeswoman Gail Marcinkiewicz yesterday, adding agents believe she has returned to Pakistan. Now, the FBI rejected Newsweek's description of Sadaki, her family, and Saudi Arabians living in the 75 Alphonsus Street high-rise apartment building as a possible Al-Qaeda sleeper cell that may have been plotting follow-up attacks to 9/11. Now, we don't believe there are cells operating in Massachusetts, Marcinkiewicz said, adding agents had thoroughly reviewed Siddiqui's activities. Newsweek obtained suspicious activity reports filed by Fleet Bank with the U.S. Treasury Department, showing Siddiqui and her now estranged husband, Dr. Muhammad Aman Khan, made repeated purchases from stores selling military equipment. They ordered from Black Hawk Industries in Chesapeake, Virginia, and Brigade Quartermasters in Georgia, companies whose inventories include parts for AK-47s and specialized combat equipment, including vests designed for bomb disposal. Khan, a Harvard-trained anesthesiologist, bought body armor, night vision goggles, and military manuals. Fleet tipped off the government to the couple in October of 2001. Federal law prohibits bank officials from discussing such reports publicly. All right, so let me pause here for a moment. Fleet Bank tracks potential transactions. And when they see these financial transactions, they report them to the FBI. You might want to turn that away if you're smart. Back for the closer. You're listening to the Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. And your support of Truth Radio and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. That's truthradio.com, truthradio.com. And Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution. Donations are not tax-deductible. Remember, if they were, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth, so we rely upon the financial support that comes from you, our listening audience, to help us pay for the satellite time, internet audio streaming, and overhead costs that we have to pay in order to bring Truth Radio to you. So we thank you very much for that continued financial support. It comes through your donations that you make to Truth Radio here at P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio, Post Office Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. All right, we're talking about Fleet Bank here. It isn't just Fleet Bank, it's every bank that keeps these kinds of records. There's no privacy when you're dealing with a bank. The Fourth Amendment does not recognize any right or expectation to your financial records, which are kept in a corporation, which is a public institution. And under the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Program or Department bureaucracy, these people, you know, just looking at this article here, I mean, they went to an Army-Navy surplus store. You know, I do that every once in a while. And let's suppose I go into an Army-Navy store and I buy something. I pay for it with a check. Well, if I pay for that with a check, it goes through the bank, goes into the bank records, and they see, oh, my God, this guy Gordon, he bought thus and such, and that's an Army surplus store. And they look at these people and says, oh, my God, these people are Pakistanis. They're Muslims. So therefore, anything that you buy in an Army-Navy store, like military manuals, well, we've got one of these Army surplus stores, and they've got military manuals in there. Now, I'm not into that kind of thing, and I don't buy them, but what if I did? The fact that they're for sale in there presupposes that they must be legal. And this Army store here sells AK-47 parts. Well, I presume that AK-47 parts that are being sold in a public store, licensed, bonded, and insured, must be legal. I mean, if you went into a Walmart store and you bought something, don't you presume that it's legal? Or they wouldn't be selling it. So just pass that one along, you know, to your friends and neighbors, and it ought to tell you a little story about banks. Banks are snitches. Banks are sitting there watching your records so that they can report you to the government. The government's not your friend. The government is there collecting information for which they can prosecute you. Now, of course, the guise that they use is that we're here to protect you. We're here to protect. Well, of course they are. They're there to protect the government, the New World Order, socialism, and communism. They're not there to protect you. If you believe that the government's there to protect Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, you do err not understanding the law. The government has no duty to protect you. any public official who says that we're here at taxpayer expense to protect you is a liar. Pure and simple. A liar. When President Bush comes over the television and says, my God, I'm here to protect the American people, President Bush is a liar. And the courts have said repeatedly that the government has no duty whatsoever to protect any citizen from any criminal act. None. Zero. Zilch. It's been litigated so many times that it's decided by stare decisis. Now, of course, politicians want to get reelected, and they want to spend your money. Your mayor and your city council and your chief of police, they all run around saying, well, we're here to protect you, the public. No, they're not. They're there to protect Circle K and 7-Eleven. They are only there to protect those entities that have a specific contract with the city, with the county, with the state, or the federal government. And those are the corporations, not Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. So tuck that one away in your heart. And then Fleet Bank over here, of course, is a stool pigeon, is a snitch looking for private individuals who might be threatening to attack one of those corporations. See, the World Trade Center, that's a corporation. And what happened was the government has a duty to protect those corporations in writing. It's the law. They have to. And so when they see an individual like these people here buying stuff, and they're Muslims, well, they're Pakistanis, we presume they're Muslims, and then they report that to the FBI. The FBI then begins their investigation, and what they're looking for here is crime. They're fishing around looking for a crime. And this bank, any bank, I don't care whether it's Fleet or Bank of America or anybody, whoever it happens to be, is there with the express purpose of acting as a stool pigeon for the government, which is there to protect corporations in the New World Order. Now, in the report, Fleet also noted the couple's major purchases from airlines and hotels and an $8,000 international wire transfer on December 21, 2001, to a major financial institution in Pakistan under U.S. watch as a source of terrorist transactions, the magazine reported. There isn't anything in this article over here that's unusual. Well, except that these people are Pakistanis, therefore they're probably Muslims, and any Muslim must be a terrorist. And if they transfer $8,000 from America to Pakistan, well, they must be terrorists. I mean, that's nonsense, pure and simple. Now, the bank is there because they get paid for this. For instance, did you know that an airline ticket clerk, you come in here and you pony up $1,000 to buy a one-way ticket to San Francisco. And she says, well, that's an unusual transaction. So she hits the button on the floor with her toe, and a couple of guys come out and arrest you. They take you in and they look you over, and they find out you got $10,000 in cash on you. They take that as an admiralty prize, and then they prosecute you. Well, now maybe you hadn't filed your tax returns for the last 5 years or whatever. And so now this is called the United States versus $10,000. Did you know that airline clerk gets 10% of that? She makes $1,000. Bank tellers do the same thing. You come in there to make a purchase. And I had a student here one day. He went in there and he wrote a check and he said, I want, $20,000 or $30,000 in cash. And so the clerk said, oh, my God, if you do that, we'll have to file a report on you. This guy's a little naive, you know. He says, well, okay, go ahead and file the report. And she said, but if you were to take this out in $9,000 increments, we wouldn't have to do that. Now, that's called structuring, and this is called entrapment. This guy wasn't intending to commit a crime. He intended to draw out $36,000, I think it was, in cash, or $30,000 in cash. They needed the cash in order to do some religious work. He was operating a kind of a religious missionary operation. So anyway, the moral of the story was they reported him for making these financial transactions. The IRS comes in, seizes his bank account, and now he has to go in and prove that he wasn't structuring or money laundering. He's not a drug dealer. Now, you see, the clerk, when she sees that, she says to herself, can I pyramid this into a 10% pay off for myself? And so she's in the business of making money, only in this case she's trying to do an entrapment. Now, that's patently illegal, but then, you know, from the clerk's point of view, it's a way to make money. Now, 2 years later, after the capture of 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he fingered Sadeki as an al-Qaeda fixer who was supposed to help operatives as they entered the United States, according to international FBI documents cited by Newsweek. Now, that's the best piece of evidence that they have so far. But it wasn't the bank that dug that up. It was somebody that was arrested and said, okay, let me confess and tell you who else is involved. But the Fleet Bank also spotted suspicious money transfers totaling $20,000 from the Saudi government's armed forces account to a man who lived in the same Boston apartment as Siddiqui. His name is Abdullah El Resid, and he's been questioned by the FBI, according to one source. Resid wrote a $20,000 check to another Saudi, Hatim El Dahri, who then wired $17,000 back to an account in Saudi Arabia, controlled by Rashid, and lived at the same address as Siddiqui. And Fleet noted in its report, the Newsweek report also highlighted the role of Riggs Bank in Washington in the transactions from Saudi Arabia. Riggs never filed any suspicious activity reports with the Treasury, prompting an investigation of the bank. Now, the Riggs accounts, according to Newsweek, showed a number of checks sent to flight schools and flight school students in the United States. Riggs also paid out $19,000 from the Saudi embassy who lived, to a guy here whose name I can't pronounce, who lives in Florida and once served as an interpreter for blind Sheikh Omar Rahman, convicted in 1996 of plotting to blow up New York City landmarks. Now, a Saudi embassy spokesman told Newsweek that the Saudis have cooperated with U.S. officials in their investigation. Senior U.S. law enforcement officials told Newsweek that the investigation into the Saudi embassy's accounts is still active. And that's a wild card. You know, the Saudis over there, of the 19 guys that flew into the Trade Center, out of 19 of these al-Qaeda guys, 19 of them were Saudis. And most of the money for this comes from Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia is our staunch ally. So it makes me kind of wonder, why not attack Saudi Arabia instead of Iraq? I never heard of anybody coming from Iraq attacking or doing jack squat. But bear in mind now that the banks are keeping track, watching what you do. Now, large amounts of money flowed back and forth between Mideast financial institutions and U.S. banks, including Fleet Bank, involving MIT graduate Sadeki, her estranged husband, Mohammed Amjan Khan, and others, according to recently published Newsweek report. Fleet investigators found that $50,000 wired from Saudi Armed Forces accounts at the Riggs Bank in Washington was sent to an unnamed student at Clark University in Worcester. Now, that's the same day. $20,000 from the same account was sent to a Saudi national named Abdullah Rashid in Boston. Neither men could be located. Now, it would seem like to me that our government would be a whole lot more concerned about $50,000 coming from the Saudi military to this woman. I mean, I'm not here to tell you that she's guilty or not guilty. I'm just here to tell you that you got banks and lending institutions spying on you. Our time is up. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next time.